Hiroshima. That's our focus on this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David Mackenzie.
The first eyewitness account of the explosion of the first atomic bomb on Japan has just come in from the Pacific. It is given by the men who carried this revolutionary new instrument over Japan and unleashed its fury squarely on the militarized city of Hiroshima. Back safely at their base, they report the blast, first of its kind in all the long history of warfare, was tremendous and awe-inspiring, and that the destruction must have been extensive. From their modest words, it's clear that this historic mission was a complete success.
It is estimated that the community known as Hiroshima, at the mouth of the Ota River in Japan, has existed since the year 1589. By 1945, Hiroshima had become known as both a military and academic center. However, on the 6th of August, 1945, the name Hiroshima became indelibly imbued with a profoundly somber aura. It was this city, because of its military base, that was chosen to be the target of the first use of the atomic bomb, just developed by the United States. What we are about to hear is a second section of a news broadcast heard in the United States on the 6th of August, 1945. And then, in commemoration of the 50th anniversary of that terrible date, a 1995 reading of the experiences of a survivor of the bombing on that day.
The men who have applied the greatest weapon ever developed, the atomic bomb, are close-mouthed, serious, and highly impressed with the world-shaking magnitude of what they've done. We talked with Colonel Paul W. Tibbetts, Jr. of Miami, Florida, pilot of the B-29 that dropped the first atomic bomb in history. You asked him how he'd felt about it, and he said he didn't feel anything much, but you knew from talking to him that he sensed the meaning of that bomb's away. The explosion was a big ball of fire. Anyone not having dark glasses would have received the visual shock several miles away. One of the crew members said, "My God," when he saw what had happened. What had been Hiroshima was a white mountain of smoke, and when we saw it first, it was already up to 25,000 feet. About 1,000 feet off the ground, it looked like boiling dust. It extended over most of the city, churning down there, and the center of the impact was in the center of the city, and the boiling continued several minutes as we watched. Then the mushroom of smoke broke off, and another developed below it. This one bomb is the equivalent of a 2,000 B-29 raid.
In memory of the Hiroshima bombing, which happened 50 years ago, today's reading is from Hiroshima Diary, the Journal of a Japanese Physician, by Michihiko Hachiya, M.D., translated and edited by Warner Wells, M.D. It begins August 6, 1945. The hour was early, the morning still, warm and beautiful. Shimmering leaves reflecting sunlight from a cloudless sky made a pleasant contrast with shadows in my garden as I gazed absently through wide-flung doors opening to the south. Clad in drawers and undershirt, I was sprawled on the living room floor, exhausted because I had just spent a sleepless night on duty as an air warden in my hospital. Suddenly, a strong flash of light startled me, and then another. So well does one recall little things that I remember vividly how a stone lantern in the garden became brilliantly lit, and I debated whether this light was caused by a magnesium flare or sparks from a passing trolley. Garden shadows disappeared. The view where a moment before all had been so bright and sunny was now dark and hazy. Through swirling dust, I could barely discern a wooden column that had supported one corner of my house. It was leaning crazily, and the roof sagged dangerously. Moving instinctively, I tried to escape, but rubble and fallen timbers barred the way. By picking my way cautiously, I managed to reach the roca and stepped down into my garden. A profound weakness overcame me, so I stopped to regain my strength. To my surprise, I discovered I was completely naked. How odd. Where were my drawers and undershirt? What had happened? All over the right side of my body, I was cut and bleeding. A large splinter was protruding from a mangled wound in my thigh, and something warm trickled into my mouth. My cheek was torn, I discovered, as I felt it gingerly, with the lower lip laid wide open. Embedded in my neck was a sizable fragment of glass, which I matter-of-factly dislodged, and with the detachment of one stunned and shocked, I studied it and my blood-stained hand. Where was my wife? Suddenly, thoroughly alarmed, I began to yell for her. Yako-san! Yako-san! Where are you? Blood began to spurt. Had my carotid artery been cut, would I bleed to death? Frightened and irrational, I called out again. It's a 500-ton bomb! Yako-san, where are you? A 500-ton bomb has fallen. Yako-san, pale and frightened, her clothes torn and blood-stained, emerged from the ruins of our house, holding her elbow. Seeing her, I was reassured. My own panic assuaged, I tried to reassure her. We'll be all right, I exclaimed. Only let's get out of here as fast as we can. She nodded, and I motioned for her to follow me. The shortest path to the street lay through the house next door, so through the house we went, running, stumbling, falling, and then running again until, in headlong flight, we tripped over something and fell sprawling into the street. Getting to my feet, I discovered that I had tripped over a man's head. Excuse me, please, I cried hysterically. There was no answer. The man was dead. The head had belonged to a young officer whose body was crushed beneath a massive gate. We stood in the street, uncertain and afraid, until a house across from us began to sway, and then, with a rending motion, fell almost at our feet. Our own house began to sway, and in a minute it, too, collapsed in a cloud of dust. Other buildings caved in or toppled. Fire sprang up and, whipped by a vicious wind, began to spread. It finally dawned on us that we could not stay there in the street, so we turned our steps toward the hospital. Our home was gone, we were wounded and needed treatment, and after all, it was my duty to be with my staff. This latter was an irrational thought. What good could I be to anyone, hurt as I was? We started out, but after 20 or 30 steps, I had to stop. My breath became short, my head pounded, and my legs gave way under me. An overpowering thirst seized me, and I begged Yako-san to find me some water. But there was no water to be found. After a little, my strength somewhat returned, and we were able to go on. I was still naked, and though I did not feel the least bit of shame, I was disturbed to realize that modesty had deserted me. On rounding a corner, we came upon a soldier standing idly in the street. He had a towel draped across his shoulder, and I asked if he would give it to me to cover my nakedness. The soldier surrendered the towel quite willingly, but said not a word. A little later, I lost the towel, and Yako-san took off her apron and tied it around my loins. Our progress toward the hospital was interminably slow, until finally my legs, stiff from drawing blood, refused to carry me farther. The strength, even the will to go on, deserted me, so I told my wife, who was almost as badly hurt as I, to go on alone. This she objected to, but there was no choice. She had to go ahead and try to find someone to come back for me. Yako-san looked into my face for a moment and then, without saying a word, turned away and began running towards the hospital. Once she looked back and waved, and in a moment she was swallowed up in the gloom. It was quite dark now, and with my wife gone, a feeling of dreadful loneliness overcame me. I must have gone out of my head, lying there in the road, because the next thing I recall was discovering that the clot on my thigh had been dislodged and blood was again spurting from the wound. I pressed my hand to the bleeding area, and after a while the bleeding stopped and I felt better. Could I go on? I tried. It was all a nightmare. My wounds, the darkness, the road ahead. My movements were ever so slow. Only my mind was running at top speed. In time, I came to an open space, where the houses had been removed to make a fire lane. Through the dim light, I could make out ahead of me the crazy outlines of the Communications Bureau's big concrete building, and beyond it, the hospital. My spirits rose because I knew that now someone would find me, and if I should die, at least my body would be found. I paused to rest. Gradually, things around me came into focus. There were the shadowy forms of people. Some of them looked like walking ghosts. Others moved as though in pain, like scarecrows, their arms held out from their bodies with forearms and hands dangling. These people puzzled me until I suddenly realized that they had been burned and were holding their arms out to prevent the painful friction of raw surfaces rubbing together. A naked woman carrying a naked baby came into view. I averted my gaze. Perhaps they had been in the bath. But then I saw a naked man, and it occurred to me that, like myself, some strange thing had deprived them of their clothes. An old woman lay near me with an expression of suffering on her face, but she made no sound. Indeed, one thing was common to everyone I saw: complete silence. All who could were moving in the direction of the hospital. I joined in the dismal parade when my strength was somewhat recovered, and at last reached the gates of the Communications Bureau. Familiar surroundings, familiar faces. There was Mr. Iguchi and Mr. Yoshihiro, and my old friend Mr. Sarah, the head of the business office. They hastened to give me a hand, their expressions of pleasure changing to alarm when they saw that I was hurt. I was too happy to see them to share their concern. No time was lost over greetings. They eased me onto a stretcher and carried me into the communications building, ignoring my protests that I could walk. Later, I learned that the hospital was so overrun that the Communications Bureau had to be used as an emergency hospital. The rooms and corridors were crowded with people, many of whom I recognized as neighbors. To me, it seemed that the whole community was there. My friends passed me through an open window into a janitor's room, recently converted to an emergency first aid station. The room was a shambles. Fallen plaster, broken furniture, and debris littered the floor. The walls were cracked, and a heavy steel window casement was twisted and almost wrenched from its seating. What a place to dress the wounds of the injured. To my great surprise, who should appear but my private nurse, Miss Kado, and Mr. Mizoguchi, and old Mrs. Seiki. Miss Kado set about examining my wounds without speaking a word. No one spoke. I asked for a shirt and pajamas. They got them for me, but still no one spoke. Why was everyone so quiet? Miss Kado finished the examination, and in a moment it felt as if my chest was on fire. She had begun to paint my wounds with iodine, and no amount of entreaty would make her stop. With no alternative but to endure the iodine, I tried to divert myself by looking out the window. The hospital lay directly opposite, with part of the roof and the third floor sunroom in plain view, and as I looked up, I witnessed a sight which made me forget my smarting wounds. Smoke was pouring out of the sunroom windows. The hospital was afire. Fire, I shouted. Fire! Fire! The hospital is on fire! My friends looked up. It was true. The hospital was on fire. The alarm was given, and from all sides people took up the cry. The high-pitched voice of Mr. Sarah, the business officer, rose above the others, and it seemed as if his was the first voice I had heard that day. The uncanny stillness was broken. Our little world was now in pandemonium. I remember that Dr. Sasada, chief of the pediatric service, came in and tried to reassure me, but I could scarcely hear him above the din. I heard Dr. Hinoy's voice and then Dr. Koyama's. Both were shouting orders to evacuate the hospital, and with such vigor that it sounded as though the sheer strength of their voices would hasten those who were slow to obey. The sky became bright as flames from the hospital mounted. Soon the bureau was threatened, and Mr. Sarah gave the order to evacuate. My stretcher was moved into a rear garden and placed beneath an old cherry tree. Other patients limped into the garden or were carried until soon the entire area became so crowded that only the very ill had room to lie down. No one talked, and the ominous silence was relieved only by a subdued rustle among so many people, restless, in pain, anxious, and afraid, waiting for something else to happen. The sky filled with black smoke and glowing sparks. Flames rose, and the heat set currents of air in motion. Updrafts became so violent that sheets of zinc roofing were hurled aloft and released, humming and twirling in erratic flight. Pieces of flaming wood soared and fell like fiery swallows. While I was trying to beat out the flames, a hot ember seared my ankle. It was all I could do to keep from being burned alive. The bureau started to burn, and window after window became a square of flame until the whole structure was converted into a crackling, hissing inferno. Scorching winds howled around us, whipping dust and ashes into our eyes and up our noses. Our mouths became dry, our throats raw and sore from the biting smoke pulled into our lungs. Coughing was uncontrollable. We would have moved back, but a group of wooden barracks behind us caught fire and began to burn like tinder. The heat finally became too intense to endure, and we were left no choice but to abandon the garden. Those who could fled, those who could not perished. Had it not been for my devoted friends, I would have died. But again they came to the rescue and carried my stretcher to the main gate on the other side of the bureau. Here a small group of people were already clustered, and here I found my wife, Dr. Sasato, and Miss Cotto joined us. Fire sprang up on every side as violent winds fanned flames from one building to another. Soon we were surrounded. The ground was held in front of the Communications Bureau, became an oasis in a desert of fire. As the flames came closer, the heat became more intense, and if someone in our group had not had the presence of mind to drench us with water from a fire hose, I doubt if anyone could have survived. Hot as it was, I began to shiver. The drenching was too much. My heart pounded. Things began to whirl until all before me blurred. "Kurushi," I murmured weakly. "I am done." The sound of voices reached my ears as though from a great distance, and finally became louder as if close at hand. I opened my eyes. Dr. Sasada was feeling my pulse. What had happened? Miss Kato gave me an injection. My strength gradually returned. I must have fainted. Huge raindrops began to fall. Some thought a thunderstorm was beginning and would extinguish the fires, but these drops were capricious. A few fell, and then a few more, and that was all the rain we saw. The first floor of the bureau was now ablaze, and flames were spreading rapidly towards our little oasis by the gate. Right then, I could hardly understand the situation, much less do anything about it. An iron window frame, loosened by fire, crashed to the ground behind us. A ball of fire whizzed by me, setting my clothes ablaze. They drenched me with water again. From then on, I am confused as to what happened. I do remember Dr. Hanoi because of the pain I felt when he jerked me to my feet. I remember being moved, or rather dragged, and my whole spirit rebelling against the torment I was made to endure. My next memory is of an open area. The fires must have receded. I was alive. My friends had somehow managed to rescue me again. A head popped out of an air raid dugout, and I heard the unmistakable voice of old Mrs. Seki. "Cheer up, doctor. Everything will be all right. The north side is burnt out. We have nothing further to fear from the fire." I might have been her son, the way the old lady calmed and reassured me. And indeed, she was right. The entire northern side of the city was completely burned. The sky was still dark, but whether it was evening or midday, I could not tell. It might even have been the next day. Time had no meaning. What I had experienced might have been crowded into a moment or been endured through the monotony of eternity. Smoke was still rising from the second floor of the hospital, but the fire had stopped. There was nothing left to burn, I thought, but later I learned that the first floor of the hospital escaped destruction largely through the courageous efforts of Dr. Koyama and Dr. Hinoy. The streets were deserted except for the dead. Some looked as if they had been frozen by death while in the full action of flight. Others lay sprawled as though some giant had flung them to their death from a great height. Hiroshima was no longer a city, but a burnt-over prairie. To the east and to the west, everything was flattened. The distant mountains seemed nearer than I could ever remember. The hills of Yoshida and the woods of Nigitsu loomed out of the haze and smoke like the nose and eyes on a face. How small Hiroshima was with its houses gone. The wind changed and the sky again darkened with smoke. Suddenly I heard someone shout, "Planes! Enemy planes!" Could that be possible after what had happened? What was there left to bomb? My thoughts were interrupted by the sound of a familiar name. A nurse calling Dr. Katsubi. "It is Dr. Katsubi. It's him," shouted old Mrs. Seiki, a happy ring to her voice. "Dr. Katsubi has come." It was Dr. Katsubi, our head surgeon, but he seemed completely unaware of us as he hurried past, making a straight line for the hospital. Enemy planes were forgotten. So great was our happiness that Dr. Katsubi had been spared to return to us. Before I could protest, my friends were carrying me into the hospital. The distance was only 100 meters, but it was enough to cause my heart to pound and make me feel sick and faint. I recall the hard table and the pain when my face and lip were sutured, but I have no recollection of the 40 or more other wounds Dr. Katsubi closed before the night. They removed me to an adjoining room, and I remember feeling relaxed and sleepy. The sun had gone down, leaving a dark red sky. The red flames of the burning city had scorched the heavens. I gazed at the sky until sleep overtook me.
The 6th of August, 1945, had been a Monday. It would not be until the following Thursday, August the 9th, that President Harry S. Truman would address the United States and the world about the atomic bomb. And his comments about it came towards the end of comments concerning the Potsdam Conference, which he had attended with Soviet Premier Stalin and British Prime Ministers Churchill. And after Winston Churchill's Conservative Party lost the national election during the conference, Clement Attlee. At the time of the broadcast, President Truman was well aware that a second atomic bomb had been dropped, this time on the city of Nagasaki, Japan. That same day, Americans would not learn that news until the following morning.
My fellow Americans, I have just returned from Berlin, the city from which the Germans intended to rule the world. It is a ghost city. The buildings are in ruins. Its economy and its people are in ruins. Our party also visited what is left of Frankfurt and Darmstadt. We flew over the remains of Kessel, Magdeburg, and other devastated cities. German women and children and old men were wandering over the highways, returning to bombed-out homes or leaving bombed-out cities, searching for food and shelter. War has indeed come home to Germany and to the German people. It has come home in all the frightfulness with which the German leaders started and waged it. The German people are beginning to atone for the crimes of the gangsters whom they placed in power and whom they wholeheartedly approved and obediently followed. We also saw some of the terrific destruction which the war had brought to the occupied countries of Western Europe and to England. How glad I am to be home again, and how grateful to Almighty God that this land of ours has been spared. We must do all we can to spare her from the ravages of any future breach of the peace. That is why, though the United States wants no territory or profit or selfish advantages out of this war, we are going to maintain the military bases necessary for the complete protection of our interests and of world peace. bases which our military experts deem to be essential for our protection and which are not now in our possession, we will acquire. We will acquire them by arrangements consistent with the United Nations Charter. No one can foresee what another war would mean to our own cities and our own people. What we are doing to Japan now, even with the new atomic bomb, is only a small fraction of what would happen to the world in a third world war. That is why the United Nations are determined that there shall be no next war. That is why the United Nations are determined to remain united and strong. We can never permit any aggressor in the future to be clever enough to divide us or strong enough to defeat us. That was the guiding spirit in the conference at San Francisco. That was the guiding spirit in the conference of Berlin. That will be the guiding spirit in the peace settlements to come. In the conference of Berlin, it was easy for me to get along in mutual understanding and friendship with Generalissimo Stalin, with Prime Minister Churchill, and later with Prime Minister Attlee. Strong foundations of goodwill and cooperation had been laid by President Roosevelt, and it was clear that those foundations rested upon more than the personal friendships of three individuals. There was a fundamental accord and agreement upon the objectives ahead of us. Two of the three conferees of Tehran and Yalta were missing by the end of this conference. Each of them was sorely missed. Each had done his work toward winning this war. Each had made a great contribution toward establishing and maintaining a lasting world peace. Each of them seems to have been ordained to lead his country in its hour of greatest need. And so thoroughly had they done their job that we were able to carry on and to reach many agreements essential to the future peace and security of the world. The results of the Berlin Conference have been published. There were no secret agreements or commitments apart from current military arrangements. And it was made perfectly plain to my colleagues at the conference that, under our Constitution, the President has no power to make any treaties without ratification by the Senate of the United States. I want to express my thanks for the excellent services which are rendered at this conference by Secretary of State Burns, and which were highly commended by the leaders of the other two powers. I am thankful also to the other members of the American delegation, Admiral Leahy and Ambassadors Harriman, Davies, and Pauley, and to the entire American staff. Without their hard work and sound advice, the conference would have been unable to accomplish as much as it did. The conference was concerned with many political and economic questions, but there was one strictly military matter uppermost in the minds of the American delegate. It was the winning of the war against Japan. On our program, that was the most important item. The military arrangements made at Berlin were, of course, secret. One of those secrets was revealed yesterday when the Soviet Union declared war on Japan. The Soviet Union, before she had been informed of our new weapon, agreed to enter the war in the Pacific. We gladly welcome into this struggle against the last of the Axis aggressors our gallant and victorious ally against the Nazis. The Japs will soon learn some more of the military secrets agreed upon at Berlin. They will learn them firsthand, and they will not like them. Before we met at Berlin, the United States government had sent to the Soviet and British governments our ideas of what should be taken up at the conference. At the first meeting, our delegation submitted these proposals for discussion. Subjects were added by the Soviet and British governments. But in the main, the conference was occupied with the American proposals. Our first non-military agreement in Berlin was the establishment of the Council of Foreign Ministers. The Council is going to be the continuous meeting ground of the five principal governments on which to reach common understanding regarding the peace settlement. This does not mean that the five governments are going to try to dictate to or dominate other nations. It'll be their duty to apply, so far as possible, the fundamental principles of justice underlying the charter adopted at San Francisco. just as the meeting at Dumbarton Oaks drew up the proposals to be placed before the conference at San Francisco, so this council of foreign ministers will lay the groundwork for future peace settlements. This preparation by the council will make possible speedier, more orderly, more efficient, and more cooperative peace settlements than could otherwise be obtained. One of the first tasks of the Council of Foreign Ministers is to draft proposed treaties of peace with former enemy countries, Italy, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, and Finland. These treaties, of course, will have to be passed upon by all the nations concerned. In our own country, the Senate will have to ratify them. But we shall begin at once the necessary preparatory work. Adequate study now may avoid the planting of the seeds of future wars. I am sure that the American people will agree with me that this Council of Foreign Ministers will be effective in hastening the day of peace and reconstruction. We are anxious to settle the future of Italy first among the former enemy countries. Italy was the first to break away from the Axis. She helped materially in the final defeat of Germany. She has now joined us in the war against Japan. She is making real progress toward democracy. A peace treaty with a democratic Italian government will make it possible for us to receive Italy as a member of the United Nations. The Council of Foreign Ministers will also have to start the preparatory work for a German peace settlement. But its final acceptance will have to wait until Germany has developed a government with which a peace treaty can be made. In the meantime, the Conference of Berlin laid down the specific political and economic principles under which Germany will be governed by the occupying powers. Those principles have been published. I hope that all of you will read them. They seek to rid Germany of the forces which have made her so long feared and hated, and which have now brought her to complete disaster. They are intended to eliminate Nazism, armament, war industry, the German general staff, and all its military traditions. They seek to rebuild democracy by control of German education, by reorganizing local government and the judiciary, by encouraging free speech, free press, freedom of religion, and the right of labor to organize. German industry is to be decentralized in order to do away with concentration of economic power in cartels and monopolies. Chief emphasis is to be on agriculture and peaceful industry. German economic power to make war is to be eliminated. The Germans are not to have a higher standard of living than their former victims, the people of the defeated and occupied countries of Europe. We are going to do what we can to make Germany over into a decent nation, so that it may eventually work its way from the economic chaos it has brought upon itself back into a place in the civilized world. The economic action taken against Germany at the Berlin Conference included another most important item, reparations. We do not intend again to make the mistake of exacting reparations in money and then lending Germany the money with which to pay. Reparations this time are to be paid in physical assets from those resources of Germany which are not required for her peacetime subsistence. The first purpose of reparations is to take out of Germany everything with which she can prepare for another war. Its second purpose is to help the devastated countries to bring about their own recovery by means of the equipment and material taken from Germany. At the Crimea Conference, a basis for fixing reparations had been proposed for initial discussion and study by the Reparations Commission. That basis was a total amount of reparations of $20 billion. Of this sum, one half was to go to Russia, which had suffered more heavily in the loss of life and property than any other country. But at Berlin, the idea of attempting to fix a dollar value on the property to be removed from Germany was dropped. To fix a dollar value on the share of each nation would be a sort of guarantee that the amount each nation would get, a guarantee which might not be fulfilled. Therefore, it was decided to divide the property by percentages of the total amount available. we still generally agreed that Russia should get approximately half of the total for herself and Poland, and that the remainder should be divided among all the other nations entitled to reparation. Under our agreement at Berlin, the reparations claims of the Soviet Union and Poland are to be met from the property located in the zone of Germany occupied by the Soviet Union and from the German assets in Bulgaria, Finland, Hungary, Romania, and East Austria. The reparations claims of all other countries are to be met from the property located in the western zones of occupation of Germany and from the German assets in all other countries. The Soviet waives all claim to gold captured by the Allied troops in Germany. This formula of taking reparations by zones will lead to less friction among the Allies than the tentative basis originally proposed for study at Yalta. The difficulty with this formula, however, is that the industrial capital equipment not necessary for German peace economy is not evenly divided among the zones of occupation. The western zones have a much higher percentage than the eastern zone, which is mostly devoted to agriculture and to the production of raw materials. In order to equalize the distribution and to give Russia and Poland their fair share of approximately 50%, it was decided that they should receive, without any reimbursement, 10% of the capital equipment in the western zones available for reparation. As you will note from the communique, a further 15% of the capital equipment in the western zones not necessary for Germany's peace economy is also to be turned over to Russia and Poland. But this is not free. For this property, Poland and Russia will give to the western zones an equal amount in value in food, coal, and other raw materials. This 15%, therefore, is not an additional reparation, is not additional reparations for Russia and Poland. It is a means of maintaining a balanced economy in Germany. And providing the usual exchange of goods between the eastern part and the western part. It was agreed at Berlin that the payment of reparations from whatever zone taken should always leave enough resources to enable the German people to subsist without sustained support from other nations. The question of Poland was the most difficult one. Certain compromises about Poland had already been agreed upon at the Crimea Conference. They obviously were binding upon us at Berlin. By the time of the Berlin Conference, the Polish Provisional Government of National Unity had already been formed, and it had been recognized by all of us. The new Polish government had agreed to hold free and unfettered elections as soon as possible on the basis of universal suffrage and secret ballot. In accordance with the Crimea Agreement, we sought the opinion of the Polish Provisional Government of National Unity with respect to its western and northern boundaries. They agreed, as did we all, that the final determination of the borders could not be accomplished at Berlin, but must await the peace settlement. However, a considerable portion of what was the Russian zone of occupation in Germany was turned over to Poland at the Berlin Conference for administrative purposes until the final determination of the peace settlement. Nearly every international agreement has in it the element of compromise. The agreement on Poland is no exception. No one nation can expect to get everything that it wants. It is a question of give and take, of being willing to meet your neighbor halfway. In this instance, there is much to justify the action taken. An agreement on some line, even provisionally, was necessary to enable the new Poland to organize itself and to permit the speedier withdrawal of the armed forces which had liberated her from the Germans. In the area east of the Curzon line, there are over 3 million Poles who are to be returned to Poland. They need room to settle. The new area in the west was formerly populated by Germans, but most of them have already left in the face of the invading Soviet army. We were informed that there were only about 1.5 million Germans left. The territory the Poles are to administer will enable Poland better to support its population. It will provide a short and more easily defensible frontier between Poland and Germany. Settled by Poles, it will provide a more homogeneous nation. The three powers also agreed to help bring about the earliest possible return to Poland of all Poles who wish to return, including soldiers, with the assurance that they would have all the rights of other Polish citizens. The action taken at Berlin will help carry out the basic policy of the United Nations toward Poland, to create a strong, independent, and prosperous nation, with a government to be selected by the people themselves. It was agreed to recommend that in the peace settlement, a portion of East Prussia should be turned over to Russia. That, too, was agreed upon at Yalta. It will provide the Soviet Union, which did so much to bring about victory in Europe, with an ice-free port at the expense of Germany. At Yalta, it was agreed, you will recall, that the three governments would assume a common responsibility in helping to establish in the liberated and satellite nations of Europe governments broadly representative of the democratic elements in the population. That responsibility still stands. We all recognize it as a joint responsibility of the three governments. It was reaffirmed in the Berlin declarations on Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary. These nations are not to be spheres of influence of any one power. They are now governed by Allied control commissions composed of representatives of the three governments which met at Yalta and Berlin. These control commissions, it is true, have not been functioning completely to our satisfaction, but improved procedures were agreed upon at Berlin. Until these states are reestablished as members of the international family, they are the joint concern of all of us. The American delegation was much disturbed over the inability of the representatives of a free press to get information out of the former German satellite nation. The three governments agreed at Berlin that the Allied press would enjoy full freedom from now on to report to the world upon all developments in Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, and Finland. The same agreement was reaffirmed also as to Poland. One of the persistent causes for wars in Europe in the last two centuries has been the selfish control of the waterways of Europe. I mean the Danube, the Black Sea Strait, the Rhine, the Kiel Canal, and all the inland waterways of Europe which border upon two or more states. The United States proposed at Berlin that there be free and unrestricted navigation of these inland waterways. We think this is important to the future peace and security of the world. We propose that regulations for such navigation be provided by international authorities. The function of the agencies would be to develop the use of the waterways and assure equal treatment on them for all nations. Membership on the agencies would include the United States, Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and France, plus those states which border on the waterway. Our proposal was considered by the conference and was referred to the Council of Ministers. There, the United States intends to press for its adoption. Any man who sees Europe now must realize that victory in a great war is not something you can win once and for all, like a victory in a ball game. Victory in a great war is something that must be won and kept won. It can be lost after you have won it, if you are careless or negligent or indifferent. Europe today is hungry. I'm not talking about Germany. I'm talking about the people of the countries which are overrun and devastated by the Germans, and particularly about the people of Western Europe. Many of them lack clothes and fuel and tools and shelter and raw materials. They lack the means to restore their cities and their factories. As the winter comes on, the distress will increase. Unless we do what we can to help, we may lose next winter what we won at such terrible cost last spring. Desperate men are liable to destroy the structure of their society, to find in the wreckage some substitute for hope. If we let Europe go cold and hungry, we may lose some of the foundations of order on which the hope for world peace must rest. We must help to the limit of our strength. And we will. Our meeting at Berlin was the first meeting of the great Allies since the victory was won in Europe. Naturally, our thoughts now turn to the day of victory in Japan. The British, Chinese, and United States governments have given the Japanese people adequate warning of what is in store for them. We have laid down the general terms on which they can surrender. Our warning went unheeded. Our terms were rejected. Since then, the Japanese have seen what our atomic bomb can do. They can foresee what it will do in the future. The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in the first attack to avoid, in so far as possible, the killing of civilians. But that attack is only a warning of things to come. If Japan does not surrender, bombs will have to be dropped on her war industry, and unfortunately, thousands of civilian lives will be lost. I urge Japanese civilians to leave industrial cities immediately and save themselves from destruction. I realize the tragic significance of the atomic bomb. Its production and its use were not lightly undertaken by this government, but we knew that our enemies were on the search for it. We know now how close they were to finding it. And we knew the disaster which would come to this nation and to all peace-loving nations, to all civilization, if they had found it first. That is why we felt compelled to undertake the long and uncertain and costly labor of discovery and production. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. Having found the bomb, we have used it. We have used it against those who attack us without warning at Pearl Harbor, against those who have starved and beaten and executed American prisoners of war, against those who have abandoned all pretense of obeying international laws of warfare. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us. The atomic bomb is too dangerous to be loose in a lawless world. That is why Great Britain, Canada, and the United States, who have the secret of its production, do not intend to reveal that secret until means have been found to control the bomb so as to protect ourselves and the rest of the world from the danger of total destruction. As far back as last May, Secretary of War Stimson, at my suggestion, appointed a committee upon which Secretary of State Burns served as my personal representative to prepare plans for the future control of this bomb. I shall ask the Congress to cooperate to the end that its production and use be controlled, and that its power be made an overwhelming influence toward world peace. We must constitute ourselves trustees of this new force to prevent its misuse and to turn it into the channels of service to mankind. It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemy, and we pray that he may guide us to use it in his ways and for his purposes. Our victory in Europe was more than a victory of arms. It was a victory of one way of life over another. It was a victory of an ideal founded on the rights of the common man, on the dignity of the human being, on the conception of the state as the servant and not the master of its people. A free people showed that it was able to defeat professional soldiers whose only moral arms were obedience and the worship of force. We tell ourselves that we have emerged from this war the most powerful nation in the world, the most powerful nation perhaps in all history. That is true, but not in the sense some of us believe it to be true. The war has shown us that we have tremendous resources to make all the materials for war. It has shown us that we have skillful workers and managers and able generals and a brave people capable of bearing arms. All these things we knew before. The new thing, the thing which we had not known, the thing which we have learned now and should never forget is this, that a society of self-governing men is more powerful, more enduring, more creative than any other kind of society, however disciplined, however centralized. We know now that the basic proposition of the worth and dignity of man is not a sentimental aspiration or a vain hope or a piece of rhetoric. It is the strongest, most creative force now present in this world. Now let us use that force and all our resources and all our skills in the great cause of a just and lasting peace. The three great powers are now more closely than ever bound together in determination to achieve that kind of peace. From Tehran and the Crimea, from San Francisco and Berlin, we shall continue to march together to a lasting peace and a happy world.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the President of the United States.
Hiroshima. A name forever stamped with the mark of profound tragedy. That concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2005. Produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I hope that you will join us again at this same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God. Do not inhabit the same space.